the future.
There are no people.
There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call.
Welcome, everybody. It is Raging Chickens Out to Coop Live. Yes, it is our call-in show for Monday, May 17th, 2021. On Out to Coop Live, we talk to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sorts, right from our own backyards or from across the country. On Friday, Sean Kitchen and I break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics for the week. You know, kind of like, you know, your politics week roundup. And we have a brand new show on Wednesdays. Yes, it's Wednesdays with Cyril is what I'm calling it at this point. Yep, every other week, progressive columnist from Bucks County Courier Times and the Intelligencer, Cyril Mikulenko, will join me to drill down into Bucks County and to PA politics. And if you want to know why the hell we care about Bucks County so much, well, you got to tune in and find out. How about that? You can check out all our shows by subscribing to our podcast on Podbeans, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. You can help support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month by going to patreon.com/rcpress. And if you're listening to this show right now on YouTube, are you listening on YouTube? Please do. Make sure you hit that subscribe button and make sure you hit that like this stream and hit that little notification bell so you know every single time we go live. We're also broadcasting live on Riverside.fm. You can join us on Riverside.fm, and you can actually call in during the second half of the show. For all those details, check us out on our YouTube channel. All the details about how to do that in here. I'm going to give you the heads up right now. This is the second week we're broadcasting with Riverside. One of our guests tonight actually helped test this out a little bit last week. So one of the things that we found out that if you do decide that you want to call in during the second half of the show, we're going to recommend you just go over, you click that link in the YouTube description, go on to Riverside, and then get off YouTube. That will prevent echoes and delays and all sorts of confusion. You can listen just on Riverside, or you can hop on over to Riverside right now and avoid all the switchover. I want to shout out to our new May patrons. Yes, thank you to Jillian for hopping into the $10 a month level. And to thanks to Christopher, who I think inspired by Jillian. Yes, I'm just going to say that. I have no evidence to support this claim, but I'm going to say it nonetheless. Christopher upped his patron level from $5 to $10 a month level. Thank you. And want to thank, you know, everybody who's just been kind of sharing this out and kind of getting the word out about the podcast. It's absolutely fantastic. For more PA Progressive Talk, you can tune into the Rick Smith Show's live stream at 9 p.m. Eastern on his YouTube channel, Twitter, Facebook, any place you can stream, you're going to find Rick there at 9 p.m. You can also subscribe to all his podcasts, his daily podcast, wherever you get your podcast. Head on over to thericksmithshow.com for all the latest from across all his platforms. And you must, that is must, underlined, all caps, all that, check out the newly launched Sisters of the Night Caucus podcast. The amazing PA women stirring the political cauldron behind this podcast rock the house. And they know where the bodies are buried. Spooky, right? You bet. Make sure to follow them on Twitter at The Night Caucus and subscribe to their podcast on Anchor, Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. And a special shout out to the folks at The Game Inn. For all you gamers out there, check out The Game Inn. That's with two N's. It's Quakertown-based, black family-owned gaming store. They're friends of the show, and they've got everything from retro N64s, the latest consoles, all sorts of video games. You're looking for games, head on over there. If you got kids, they get A's in the report cards, they get a discount. I mean, come on. Check out The Game Inn. Look them up on Facebook. Check them out on Twitter at The Game Inn for all your gaming needs. And a special shout out to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter at SongADayMan. That's with two N's, at SongADayMan on Twitter. Welcome, everybody. And, you know, this week's show, I welcome Nick Marcel. Marcel, did I get that right? Marcel?
Marcel.
I forgot to ask you that before the show. That's great. And then an Alex Carlesis. Did I get that one right? All right,
there we go.
You know, sometimes it's the little things that I just forget
for
the show.
Two
awesome.
For two.
There you go. There you go. Well, Nick and Alex are graduate students at Westchester University, and they wrote this awesome piece for the student newspaper, The Quad, called "The Hallmarks of Neoliberalism Pervade PA System of Higher Education." In that piece, they argue, quote, "While the promise of market efficiency can seem tempting under such bleak circumstances, it is not a sustainable model of increased access or more abundant resources in higher education. In fact, despite the increasing reliance on this model, inflation-adjusted per-student state funding has declined in 41 states since 2008, according to a study by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. In PA alone, we have seen about a 40% reduction since the year 2000 in state funding across the board, even as universities continue to struggle and threaten to shut their doors," unquote. Well, now Alex and Nick are helping launch a new organization, Poshi Defenders. They'll be fighting for a fully funded state system of free public higher education. And it sounds like an appropriate addition to the Marvel Universe, if you ask me, and I'm all in. You can find them on Twitter at Defenders Poshi. That's P-A-S-S-H-E, Defenders Poshi. And look them up on Instagram at Poshi_Defenders. And it turns out today is actually a good day to have them on. We were not planning this. But earlier today, the PA Senate Democratic Caucus Policy Committee held a hearing on Poshi consolidation plans. State Senators Katie Muth, Lindsey Williams, and Judy Swank led questions of panels featuring faculty, staff, students, and administrators. Let me give you a little introduction to Nick. Nick is a first-year higher education policy and student affairs master's student at Westchester University, current graduate assistant for student engagement, the Center for Civic Engagement and Social Impact, and will be returning there next year. He graduated from Westchester University in May 2020, where he majored in early grades preparation and a minor in mathematics education. And Alex Carlesis is a first-year higher education policy and student affairs master's student, also at Westchester. She is a current graduate assistant in the Twardowski.
Yeah,
there you go. I should know this. My wife is Polish, and she would not be happy with my lack of ability to pronounce that. But the Career Development Center and thoroughly enjoys counseling students and helping them with their postgraduate plans. She was also recently elected as the vice president of the Graduate Student Association and plans to use her platform to promote and plan programming for first-generation students, as well as help graduate students obtain any resources they need to help secure funding or further aid for their studies. She graduated from the University of Delaware in 2017, where she majored in English and journalism. Nick and Alex, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us. Excited to be here.
Thank you.
Well, yeah. Well, I'm so glad you could. I'm so glad you could come on. I think, you know, when you all had sent me the editorial a while back that you had written for the Quad, I knew like instantaneously. I said, okay, I got to have you all on. And then it's like, you know, end of the semester and kind of like craziness. And so I'm finally glad we got it. And it actually turns out that this is, you know, it's a good time. I mean, one, we've got our...
Pretty fortuitous.
Yes, exactly. The day of these hearings and after like the grades are in and the final projects are hopefully done for the semester. Right.
Oh my gosh, thank God.
off the plate. Glad to be.
Well, a lot of times, you know, this is not true this past year, but most of my teaching is generally with undergraduates. So I'm curious, mm-hmm. I mean, we did talk about this before the show, but I'm just out of curiosity. I mean, what was this experience like, I mean, during COVID as graduate students? I mean, did it seem a complete, like, aberration and insane, like, as insane as it was at the undergraduate level, or?
Yeah, I actually think we kind of lucked out as graduate students, just because obviously, it wasn't ideal because I fully believe that education should be held in a classroom or at least in an environment that fosters and supports, like, you know, really being able to engage fully with your counterparts, with your classmates. And I just don't think that Zoom is, you know, is a feasible way to be able to accomplish that goal. However, because our classes were so discussion based and we transitioned from an in-person semester to an online course. We started this program online. I think it allowed us to adapt much more quickly, as well as just be able to almost kind of overcompensate in a way, since we knew going in that we were going to start this program online again. We knew like, okay, like, and this is, wasn't just true for Nick and I, this is true for every person that was in our like 25 person cohort, right, or so. It was just a blessing to have them just be able to really hit the ground running, really launch into our learning. And I just feel like without the support of our faculty too, they, I know, gave 110% to their classes. They listened to us when we needed breaks, and they just were able to really treat us like adults, which, even though I do think that more of that should be happening at the undergraduate level, I really do think it's more, there is more natural junctions for that at the graduate level of study, which is, I found to be really appreciative.
And I'll say from, in a sense, the negative side of things of within our program,
we're doing,
right?
We're doing good cop, bad cop all day long here?
We'll probably switch roles throughout.
There you go.
It's going to happen. But no, in the sense of, you know, for our program, we're very much focused on like student affairs. And, you know, it definitely was a detriment with things being online and not really being able to interact with students as much, you know, definitely, with different programs or services, you know, and to an extent of like sort of bad thing, I mean, it made us more able to, I'll say, overcommit in terms of, I know plenty of other graduate students who, you know, they had other jobs which they could work more hours. Now that sounds sort of great, and that's like a great accessibility piece that we can talk a little bit later, you know, with Chancellor Greenstein sort of talking about how, oh, students want online and this and that, but, you know, don't dig into the factors that it's like, well, I need more time to be able to work, to pay my bills, to go to school, to live, you know, and things like that. So it's its own, as Alex said, there were a lot of good things that came with it, specifically I think in our, you know, program and being at the graduate level. But for a lot of people, you know, as we all know, at like especially at the undergraduate, that it was, you know, it was hard, it was detrimental.
Well, I mean, I think Greenstein would agree on this one, that, you know, if you make students up, they actually are a lot more compliant and agreeable. So that's, so you just make them up out of whole cloth and you can do it like this. But I do think it's interesting.
Well, I agree. And
yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, Alex.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that, yeah, I actually wrote a paper about this where I do think that there has been all this focus on undergraduate student populations, and rightly so, because they are at like more tender ages and stuff like that. They're still figuring out their educative development and that kind of stuff. And that's all really important to focus on. However, I do think that the graduate student populations are one of the most vulnerable populations on a university's campus, because we are, you know, it is more likely that we are sustaining our own form of education and our own access to education, as well as, you know, having to pay our own bills. Not trying to discount any undergraduate students' experiences. I'm just saying it is sometimes more likely that you will find that graduate students are at these really crucial inflection points that really put pressure and make us more vulnerable. And therefore that, I think, leads to this idea of surplus obedience and being obedient to the university and just being, you know, feeling really vulnerable and exploited as a result, which I think, you know, is all about like our article kind of talks about, that just like the sheer exploitation of these students of all ages.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, here we are like in the middle of the pandemic. I mean, you're both coming in first year graduate students in the midst of all this. Mm-hmm. You're talking about these experiences. And then so, of course, you decide that, you know, with everything that's on your plate, you think, OK, this is a good time to kind of launch a critique of PASHI and neoliberalism and start an organization as well. Right. But seriously, I think that, you know, that vantage point, I think, Alex, what you're describing in part does provide some additional context. I think that's important for even what's kind of, say, motivates, you know, that article at that time, because it does seem, I read it as not only just an excellent critique. And, you know, again, I should plug it once again for everybody. The links are going to be in the show notes, but it's called Hallmarks of Neoliberalism Pervade PA State or PA System of Higher Education. And this is in the quad, and the link will be in the show notes. So you can read the entire thing, but it's kind of like a culmination of this experience too, as well. And an analysis of, you know, despite the fact that we're going through this pandemic, right. We've all are in this shared crisis. That's precisely the moment, as you mentioned in your piece, where Greenstein decided to kind of like ramp up, you know, the decision-making speed to make these transformations in the Pashi system right now. It's like never let the good crisis go to waste, right? So why don't we talk a little Alex, so why don't you start this off then, talk a little bit about kind of what was behind this piece and kind of what you want, what you were trying to accomplish there.
Absolutely. So it actually started off in one of our classes with one of our professors, Dr. Wozniak, and the class is called Issues of Power and Privilege Within Higher Education, which is just a fancy way of phrasing like what exactly is wrong with the meritocracy that, you know, and the elite status and the ruling class that has started to take over and cannibalize higher education. So Nick and I thought we started learning about this topic of disaster capitalism, which was a term coined by Dr. Naomi Klein. And she coined it back in 2004 with the Hurricane Katrina disaster, when the levees broke and they actually figured out that the Society of Engineers down there had multiple opportunities to repair and fix them, but because they wanted to be able to completely run this system into the ground and further consolidate their control over the city, they let it's been found out through multiple reports and multiple studies that the levees were just allowed to break and the flood defenses therefore collapsed. So we're sort of seeing our professor was making the connection, and our classmates started piling on top of that in the great discussions that we had, that we're starting to see the same thing happen with higher education, and then more specifically with Pashi, where we're deliberately running a system into the ground. We're underfunding it. We're undercutting it. Pennsylvania now ranks 47th out of 50 states in terms of worst higher education funding. So we're deliberately undercutting these programs, letting them starve out. And then we're using that as an excuse of saying, well, look, it's not working. See, now you need to decentralize all of this. You need to let it be under our control. We need to consolidate more of these universities, have it be more under control of the Board of Governors, of the Chancellor, of, you know, fewer presidents and fewer voices and things like that. And then you're kind of left with students like Nick and myself, like the undergraduate population, like even faculty,
right,
not having as much of a voice in how things are conducted. Nick, I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that.
Yeah, and then even specifically, you've seen it with Chancellor Greenstein of, you know, him throwing out the funding formula and having his financial sustainability-esque, you know, plans, which originally I believe were 5 years and then consolidated to like, you know, 3 or 2. And, you know, all that is that, you know, as Naomi Klein coined, of disaster capitalism, because it's, you know, just creating a problem and then saying, well, we need to be more financially sustainable or have the market solve this problem. We need to, you know, go have things go online because that's where growth is and supposed demand for, you know, higher education. Or we need to look at, you know, which current jobs are in the highest demand, not what students want in terms of education, but what supposedly the market, which is supposedly all-knowing and, you know, really has a grasp over things, but, you know, doesn't, you know, that wants and what that demands instead of the students themselves.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think that whole idea of, you know, I'm a huge fan of Naomi Klein, and anybody who's listened to this show, who's been listening to the show for a while, has been steeped in the doctrine of disaster capitalism, believe me. some of my first pieces that I ever wrote for Raging Chicken were exactly on the shock doctrine. And what was happening this, right? I've been writing about this since 2011, and kind of charting some of this history, and it's exactly as you all say. And I think that even to add that piece to it, where, you know, what, you know, the shock doctrine folks, right, the disaster capitalists that are out there, you know, on the one hand, they've got the natural disasters like Katrina, exactly as you're saying, Alex. And then on the other hand, they realize, hey, you know, we can make these disasters on our own, right? We can we can either, you know, do one giant swoop of cuts, right, and then defund, or what happened with Pashi, right, over the course of several decades, we can just kind of gradually bleed it dry to the point where you've got someone like Chancellor Greenstein right now is able to go to, you know, before these hearings and say things like, look, we're out of choices. There's nothing that we can do. I mean, this is the whole Tina thing, right? The Margaret Thatcher, it will haunt us forever as long as we live within this logic.
And it really goes back to, you know, like the fact of neoliberalism being sort of not necessarily like being sort of a rationality of the market and like how that, you know, should dictate things. Because everything that, you know, Chancellor Greenstein says, you know, it's not like him doing the decisions. It, you know, he, you know, sort of puts it on the legislature, you know, like in part to blame, but then says, you know, because of this, I need to react according to what the market is telling me, not what I want to do, but it is what he wants to do. You know, if you're doing this, as he has even stated, you know, your, you know, whatever you do, like, it's a policy choice. So this is a policy choice for him to, you know, have austerity on PASHE and, you know, continually cut. And yet it's very contradictory to some of the things that you might hear from him, because he'll say, oh, well, you know, we can't cut our way out of this. We need to grow. Well, you are literally cutting and then saying that we can grow in, you know, the supposed like online world of education. I don't think that that's going to happen. And I think that what I believe it was Apscuff that shared a, you know, great article about in Vermont, their state of higher education, and of how, you know, they had an influx of students and they really needed to ramp up the amount of staff and faculty that they had there. And that's exactly what I think could become a problem for PASHE in the near future if these cuts, you know, continue to cement and then a bunch of students want to actually come in and, you know, get a quality higher education. But
yeah, and it seems like we're all starting from the conclusion, right? And this is one of the moves that I think that Chancellor Greenstein has made that, you know, that you pick up on very well in this piece, right? I mean, basically, you're talking about this policy choice, right? And he'll even come and he'll acknowledge and say, hey, yeah, you know, we could increase funding, right? Mm-hmm. But what's unsaid in that is like, we know that's not going to happen, right?
Exactly. The subtext is almost as loud as what he's saying.
Exactly, right? So we could do this. Sure, we could. There's another path out, except this is a policy choice. And what I find fascinating about this guy, and this is one of the things that I've, you know, I've said about him since he came here, is like he's a smooth operator. And yeah, he knows how to do this. And I think that in many ways, our state legislators are kind of outmatched. Like they don't know what to do with a guy who comes in with like, you know, the Gates Foundation, like, credentials and comes and says, sure, we have other options. We can raise funding. Are you going to do that? And you almost can feel those legislators kind of looking down and shuffling papers around like, he's not talking to me. Right. But that's the point. It's like, what essentially is at the core of this, right? And you, again, this is one of the things that you address in your piece, is like, well, look, there are other options, right? Is that we don't need to live within the boundaries of austerity, right, to begin there. And, you know, in many cases, we could say this is a policy choice, yes, indeed. But thus far, it seems to me, I mean, I don't know if you'd all agree with me on this, but it seems to me that up until now, we've also been stuck within this model of like, we just have to defend what exists. And that it's just not sufficient. Right. I mean, because I think you say this directly in here, because look, if Greenstein goes, just another body's going to come in and fill his place. Right.
Well, exactly. Because that is what I think is draining about, you know, can sometimes be draining about activism and things like that, because not only do we have to push for something new, but sometimes we find ourselves defending what already exists, which we don't like either.
Right.
And that is what that two-pronged offense, defense kind of those scenarios, it can be exhausting, and it splits up your focus and your commitment. And sometimes it can, if you don't have really solid messaging and retool your thinking and make it as consistent as possible, you can lose people in the weeds very easily. And that's something that I worry about as an activist. Like, I don't want to sit here in an ivory tower and just talk about Baumol's cost disease and like all this stuff that's pervading the institutions of higher education. But at the same time, it's like, okay, well, how do I talk about this in ways that like people are going to care? Because I don't blame people if I throw out an economic forecast, that doesn't even interest me.
Right.
You know?
Sure.
Like Nick and I will literally be talking about Board of Governors meetings and he'll be like, Alex, like, did you hear this? I'm like, Nick, I don't care.
Well, I mean, you know, that's what it's all designed to do in that certain way.
Exactly.
But also to go back to what you were saying was of, yeah, we very much intentionally, I mean, we used the chancellor in a sense as a figure, but not as like the central figure of everything is on him.
Right.
There's a lot that's on him in that way. But the idea of, as you were saying, that, you know, someone else is just going to come right in and is going to do the exact same thing, because that's exactly what the system is sort of designed to do. And that's what we need to fight back, you know, against and try to push against that. It's sort of like, you know, one of my favorite authors, Howard Zinn, you know, him sort of talking about like a people's history of the United States and saying of how it's not necessarily like this one figure that, you know, like does everything. It's these movements, it's people who come together and actually do this hard work to be able to, you know, make this transformational change happen. And that's very much what we're trying to do, and trying to also tell people that, yes, do I want to see, you know, Chancellor Greenstein gone on the side of the road? Yeah, I think that would be fun. But at the same time, that's not going to fix everything. What we need to really do is try to, you know, pressure the system as a whole in different, you know, ways to make this transformational change happen.
Well, you know, I think that, and this is one of the things, right, we're kind of right at this exact point of why I thought your piece was so on point, is because we've seen for, you know, decades. I mean, you know, I've been in this game for a while. You know, I mean, I've been whatever. I mean, I've been at Kutztown since 2002, right? So I started my graduate work in what, like 91, 93, something like 91, right? So I've been in this for a while. And, you know, the critiques about neoliberalism, the critiques of this, and I think, you know, frankly, I think Naomi Klein, why I love Naomi Klein so much is because, you know, she's not like a, you know, a post-structuralist theorist, right? I mean, she's a journalist and she's writing to a much more popular audience. Mm-hmm. And I think she can, she's an amazing communicator. Right. And, but I mean, all those kind of, the analysis of kind of what it is that we're actually battling against, which you name in here, you talk about neoliberalism and all this. And so, but your piece doesn't end with like, and so, let's defeat neoliberalism. End of piece, right? I mean, it's like, no, we're starting this organization, right? Or we're starting this organization. Here's an email address to get in touch with. And so, you know, you kind of make that move to say, okay, we're not just going to just say, lay out the critique, which is, you know, I would argue necessary, but then say, now we need to do things, right? And I think that's the shift that has been, I think, missing for a long time. And now we're at the point where you're saying, okay, yeah, Pashi Defenders, right? Go Marvel, right? Here we go. So talk to me a little bit about what, you know, what you're, you know, I understand that, you know, at least my impression is, correct me if I'm wrong, that you're, this is kind of an organization that's kind of getting off the ground, right? That you're beginning to kind of assemble, right? You know, Avengers Assemble.
I was just about to say, Defenders Assemble.
Right, exactly. And so walk us through a little bit about what this organization is and what you hope it to be and kind of where you see yourself kind of taking this, right? And why, you know, why start it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
So yeah, Nick, go ahead.
No, you can go ahead, Alex.
Oh, I was just going to say that, yeah, Nick and I got together after we, like, as we were writing the op-ed, I think it became more and more clear that exactly as you were saying, Kevin, it's not going to be enough just to have one more op-ed out there that talks about dismantling neoliberalism. Like, it's, this is going to require organized, concerted, grassroots efforts, like how any systemic meaningful change has started. And so I think as we were writing it, we sort of got more and more momentum and inspiration to just be able to build and start this organization. And we were encouraged by some of the faculty at Westchester. We've received some great support from some members of our cohort, which has been wonderful. So I think what we have planned to do, and as we have like started to list our goals out, is to essentially create or fight for a fully funded state system of free public higher education that is funded through progressive taxation. We believe in college for all. We think that eliminating tuition and relying more heavily on, again, progressive taxation will be able to help boost and eliminate these this robust elimination of neoliberal principles for, again, this funding and maintenance of the system that everybody seems so worried about, but no one will actually propose propose solutions for how to, when people say that we're unhappy with the system, they'll, you know, Greenstein, the chancellor, and everybody else will just say, well, you don't have anything better, so there you go. And it's like, okay, well, we're going to try and come up with something better now. Nick, yeah, anything that I left out?
Yeah, no. And I'll say part of the reason why we're very much strong advocates for college for all, and yes, we very much know that's not something that's likely to happen necessarily just in the state of PA, mm-hmm. and is something that, you know, is more something you've seen on the federal level with people like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren maybe, you know, proposing to have that, you know, as federal policy. But it's something to really work towards and have as, you know, what we really strive for, because that is actually going to solve like the crucial problems. Because having a system where it relies on student tuition is inherently regressive, mm-hmm. And very much hurts the most marginalized students the most. Mm-hmm. That's very much what it's intended to do. And to eliminate a lot of the, I'll say, you know, like markets that emerge into the higher education system, it needs to be free. It needs to be unconditional. It needs to be something where it doesn't matter what major that I want to go to, because I need to get XYZ major, you know, in order to get a good job, or like, you know, this is what my parents want. No, it's going to be something that's free for everyone. And it should be, because just like K-12 education is for free in this country, quote unquote, there are still, you know, mm-hmm. plenty of barriers, and it's not equitable. I agree with that. But, mm-hmm. you know, we want that to transition into higher education, because there was a time when it was free. Now, not for mm-hmm. everyone, you know, primarily for like white men like myself, but in the sense of it, you know, having been sort of like free or virtually free, we really need to reimagine that idea that the university itself is a public good and should be treated as such, as a free mm-hmm. public good in that sort of regard.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, we are strong proponents of Dr. Wendy Brown and her teachings mm-hmm. of that education needs to be considered a public good again. And we are going to borrow a lot, I think, from the strategies and the words of the Bay Area protesters back in the 1960s and 70s, who they knew, even when they were looking down the barrel of the very beginnings of neoliberalism, but definitely the strong holdings sure. of neoliberalism within the United States, and specifically within the educational fields. They knew that their only way for true liberation, or the path to liberation, was a free was free education, and they took advantage of that. And as soon as they started to, that's when and the populations became browner, black, more women started to enter campuses. Ronald Reagan and a bunch of, you know, Noam Chomsky and everybody else, like, they just saw that as a threat, and they knew that they had to really bite back and push back on that. And we've just seen time and time again, as Nick has stated, that a tuition-based system of higher education is inherently regressive, because even as these tuitions rise, none of the money is funneled back into instruction or professors. There is a great article in The Atlantic called the corner that state universities have backed themselves into. And it's just, we've seen that the universities are shoveling out all of these services to adjunct faculty who are poorly paid and overworked. And so therefore, the absolute crux of what education is supposed to be about, education with fully funded like professors who are there to engage their students, we're seeing that is rapidly becoming more on the decline, which is, that I think is like one of the most depressing things to see. So I think that's also ties into our goals a lot as well.
And to also say, of course, you know, the real, like, you know, the real thing that we're trying to do now is, as we sort of talked about a little bit before, is defend what we have now and stop consolidation, and, you know, get to a fully funded university through the state. You know, there once was a time not too long ago, realistically, where we got about, I think it was $700 million a year or something like that in like the year 2000 or 2001, adjusted for inflation, of course. But okay. And, you know, now we're at like what, like 420, 450 million, maybe.
Million, something like that.
And, you know, it's just laughable in that sense. So, you know, really trying to see what we can do. Go ahead, Kevin.
No, exactly. Well, this is from Catherine. Catherine's the YouTube chat. I'm sorry. Catherine was saying, like, talking about Greenstein here, he talks down to students because they are not organized. Students have power but don't work collectively, so they don't scare people in power, right? And when students are organized with an agenda and demands, the administration responds. And I would say this is also true of faculty, and this is also true of our communities, right? When we're talking about the, you know, as we like to say on Out the Coop, we like to say raising chicken is like, you know, direct action gets the goods. And, you know, and I think that we've seen this now with, you know, generations now. We can say, you know, I don't want to have everything always come back to the Bernie Sanders campaign, but I think the Bernie Sanders campaign did have had a lot to do with this, as did the Women's March, as did Indivisible, as did Black Lives Matter, basically showing that, you know, people are in a position now where they're making demands for a different kind of world, not just for, you know, can we reorder the, you know, the chairs on the deck of the Titanic? We're going to actually kind of like argue for a different world. And one of the things that struck me about today's hearings, it was the same thing that struck me about during the last couple of hearings, is even those hearings, as important as they are, and as, you know, I understand they're narrowly focused, but the issue that has not been discussed at any of these hearings has been, you know, the real problem, which is the historic defunding of public higher education, the walking away from the idea of the public, right? And a commitment to public, free public higher education. And I remember, you know, this is the one thing that I've said this 1,000 times over too as well, where I think that, you know, this is where it's on us as faculty. When we went on strike in 2016, we really squandered an opportunity. In my view, like, we saw a piece of what that future looked like when we had students and faculty and community members kind of organized together. And we saw that we could do something different here. When we're organized together, that we can actually accomplish something. And, you know, I'm not going to even kind of like have conjectures about why it is this happened, but things start, you know, went back to business as usual. And we lost that opportunity of power. And now it just seems to me is like with the kind of work that you all are doing, so starting up this organization, and there was another student organization at that time, the Student Power Network, right? PA Student Power Network was trying to do a similar kind of move, making the same kind of demands. And it seems to me is like, look, I mean, especially you all, right? I mean, it's like, we got options here. Like, what, you know, what do we take on more student debt, right? Were we, you know, how long are we going to put off even be, you know, finding a place to live? I mean, how many times are we going to be like, you know, living with 10 other people in a room just to be able to make things by? How long are we going to sustain ourselves over minimum wage jobs until we hope we kind of land a position of what we want? It just seems like, you know, we're out of options. And it's this idea about arguing for, you know, the crumbs, in my view, we got to be like, wash our hands of it. We got to be done with it. But
absolutely. At some point, I think I obviously understand the validity of focusing a portion of our argument on the economic side of things. But as Nick and I have discussed, where we win this battleground is to start shifting the conversation towards the moral argument, which neoliberalism literally prevents you from doing. And in order to defeat and hopefully, like, you know, eventually dismantle this way of thinking, it's like we have to sort of shift into this conversation of no, but like the moral argument of this, we are the richest country in the world, and students have to go into, so many of our students have to go into debt for an undergraduate education that they might not necessarily even need, but they've been sort of tricked due to return on investment metrics and market metrics have been almost tricked into thinking that they need in order to survive in this world. Because again, through all the interrelated networks of stagnant wages and breaking of unions and things like that. It's just like, it's almost impressive how systemic this is.
And, you know, also their economic argument continues to go back to this idiotic notion, I'll say, of accessibility, right? You know, I myself right now, yeah, I, you know, have accessibility into getting a healthcare plan, right? But myself as a graduate student and, you know, someone who is right now cutting grass in the summer somewhat to, you know, make a little bit of money, I'm sorry, a healthcare plan is very expensive. I don't think that, you know, someone who's my age is necessarily going to do that. But yet when an emergency comes, it's going to cost me a lot of money. And maybe it was a good thing if I had that healthcare plan. You know, there needs to be the understanding, just like with healthcare, you know, for all, like, you know, with Medicare for All, as Bernie Sanders very much advocated for. It's the same reason for College for All. It needs to be there. Like, there is a reason, because it helps in the sense of, you know, do you want an educated democracy where people can actually, you know, like, discuss ideas? And, you know, as John Dewey was a huge proponent of, you know, education, you know, it's very much a civic education and how you are going to be, quote unquote, like a citizen of, you know, your nation, of the world, you know, and really be able to interact with others.
Well, the crazy thing for me is just that we're not even kind of like inventing this, right? I mean, this is like catching up to the rest of like the world.
Exactly.
I mean, it's, you know, I mean, that's the astounding thing here is that, you know, you start talking about free college for all, in we can get ourselves in this mentality that like, oh my God, this is this radical idea. We gotta temper our, I mean, this is just normal to most of the world. You know, this is just kind of like, oh, wait a minute, you got, I mean, I love these, you know, you've probably seen these before. There's, you know, these little memes, you see this on TikTok, the things like saying, you know, things I learned by traveling abroad or working abroad about being an American, right? Like, you know, when I went to the hospital, and I asked, like, you know, how much? And they looked at me with strange light. Or when I said, what do you guys do if you're sick? I mean, do you call in sick? If you're sick from work, you stay home because you're sick, right? And they're like, absolutely. Well, how many sick days do you have? And they look at you like you're crazy. Like, what do you mean? How can I predict how many days I'm going to be sick ahead of time? I can't, right?
Right. Yeah, once again, it's the moral argument of everything. And it's not treating people as units of human capital. And I think bleeds into, again, why graduate students, I feel like, are at such a crossroads and at, you know, really just one of the most vulnerable populations. Right. So speaking from personal experience, I turned 26 this year. I got kicked off my parents' health insurance plan. I had to go to the PA marketplace. I have an extremely high deductible. And knowing that Westchester, which is a wonderful institution that I am like thrilled that I get to attend, it's like, it almost makes me, it forces me to choose between being a rah-rah like student proud to go here and someone who feels so absolutely like shattered when I have to choose between healthcare or like, I just don't have the time to have a full-time job anymore because I'm going to school. So it's literally making me choose between my education and between my healthcare. And it's like, why can't I have both?
Right. And
you're sitting here telling me that I have to choose. And then, yeah, like you were saying, how am I going to predict how many days out of the year I'm going to be sick? How can I predict if I'm going to get into an accident, God forbid, or something like that? That's just like, it's reverse logic at its finest.
Right. And as Catherine says here, we are their richest country, but college students are homeless and use campus food banks to eat. Right. There's exactly what I want to remind everybody is that you can help support what we're doing right here at the Raging Chicken. You can help support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month by going to patreon.com/RCPress. And make sure that if you're listening to us on YouTube right now, you're watching the stream, make sure you subscribe to this is the way that we promote the show and kind of get it out. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Make sure you like this stream right now. Make sure you hit that notification bell so you know every time you go live and share it with your friends. And want to make sure that, you know, once again, that you know that you can check out the work that Posse Defenders is doing, you want to make sure that you head on over to their Twitter page or head on over and follow them on Twitter at Defenders Posse. That's one word, Defenders Posse, P-A-S-S-H-E. And you can check them on Instagram at Posse _ Defenders. Now, I also understand, I do want to say if anybody does have additional comments, you've got questions for folks who are actually tuning in right now, feel free to throw them down in the YouTube chat. You can also, if you're watching us on YouTube right now, you can also join our Discord, where we can continue this and do discussions after the show. Make sure you kind of sign up for our Discord server there. We'll be heading out in the live chat. You can live chat during the show. And if you are listening right now on Riverside.fm, you will also be able to call into the show. So if you, anybody does want to call in, you have additional questions you want to post to the chat, feel free to do that before the show winds out. So now, I want to get back to Posse Defenders a little bit here, because I know that you all have a meeting that you're planning on coming up, right? On Thursday, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So
Thursday at 7.
Thursday at 7. So walk us through. Give us the plug.
Yeah, so, you know, we are meeting Thursday at 7. There is a Google form. You can find that on our Twitter. I believe I either have it as a tweet or if not, I also think I have it in the Twitter bio. So, you know, fill that out. We're sort of going to be talking a little bit about the mission of our organization. So some of the stuff that you've heard here, as well as some additional things, sort of our quote unquote state of the system. As we know, Chancellor Greenstein always does his yearly state of the system. So we wanted to do our own to really show what the state of the system is. And then also sort of talking about some of our organizing plans, some of the things that we're thinking of doing, and some of the ways in which we together, not just you as an individual, but we together can work together to stop this consolidation and really fight for better funding for higher education in PA.
I just dropped that link into the YouTube chat and into Riverside chat. Yep. And I will put that, make sure that is in the show notes too as well. I'm sorry to interrupt, Alex.
Oh, no. I was just going to say the link is also in our Instagram bio as well, if you are not a Twitter user.
Cool. So now I know this is going to be casting a little bit further into the future here. But, you know, if you're imagining, you know, this is always one of the struggles, right, in organizing in higher education, is that you have a thing that we call the summer, right? Which, like, on the one hand, is, you know, it's very often seen as that, you know, this is the difficult time for kind of organizing. At the same time, it's like, you know, one could also argue it's a great time to organize, right? Because we're not preoccupied with primarily focus on our studies and so on, but we're all kind of in different places right now. But if you're kind of imagining kind of that, you know, fast forward through the summer, so we're getting ready to head back into the fall. In most cases, unless we see another crazy outbreak, probably we're going to be face-to-face in the fall. What do you see as kind of like some of the, you know, at least issues that you'd like to see on the table? I mean, like you said, this is not just you two, right? You know, that there's other folks who want to be part of defining this. But what are some of those things that you'd like to see on the table going back into the fall?
So, I mean, I would say, you know, depending on how we can, you know, get people together and, you know, in our on our Google form and such, you know, we have a good amount of people, I'll say, who have signed up and even, you know, from universities across the state system. And, you know, I would really want, you know, those, I'll say, quote unquote, like student leaders, you know, who really know their concerns within their own university to, one, you know, fight for what is local and what is, you know, necessary and needed there. You know, but, you know, not just necessarily looking at tuition, but also looking at housing, looking at food. You know, I know that at a lot of our institutions, housing is something where it's sort of, I know at least at Westchester, it's sort of like a two-tiered system in the sense that there is a nonprofit, which is the Westchester University Foundation, which sort of manages those as a nonprofit, but is sort of profiting in a way, you know, through these nicer, newer buildings versus the older traditional style residence halls. You know, or you have something in terms of food, like like you have Aramark, I know at, you know, Westchester University, at many of the other PASHI institutions, that there are certain deals with Aramark, and it would be really interesting and great to try to fight against those deals and try to see if there's a way to, you know, get campus dining to be something free for Westchester University students or PASHI students, you know, as a whole, depending on their institution. And, you know, something where maybe we could change some of the agreements. I know specifically at Westchester University, I want to say it's maybe 80% or 75% or something like that of the food that is served, like, you know, let's say on campus, has to be Aramark food. Like, you know, there are certain agreements when it comes to that. And that prevents a lot of things. I know that that's one of the reasons why you could say the campus gardens are not as big as they are in Westchester. And I'm sure is, you know, the same with a lot of other universities. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, no, and I just think adding to the wonderful things that Nick says, I really want to, I think we really want to use this summer to do what, like, you know, we want to do in the future, to educate our, not only our members that join us, but even in terms of our outreach as well. So making sure that we are able to get people to understand that consolidation equals, like it's going to lead to all of these, like bad things, like job reductions, retrenchment, like funding will shrink overall by 11% by like 2023. Student services and sports programs, they face elimination. So this consolidation is not going to be a good thing, even though it, you know, it sounds tempting, it sounds fancy, it sounds intriguing, and that it might be easier and like make our lives easier. It's actually not going to in the long run. And then also for further educating ourselves in that this all connects. So even if you don't think that it affects you today, like if you like play, like I just said, like if you play a sport, if you're thinking you want to become a college professor in the future, if you think that you might want to go back to school for a graduate degree at a PASHI school, or if you're if you're even younger than that, if you're 18 and you're facing paying for college by yourself, all, and like you're going to face skyrocketing tuition rates, even though it's initially this consolidation might initially promise that it will lower them. The studies are showing, and like policies being released, or reports being released by the Budget and Policy Center, are showing the opposite of that. So it's just really being able to educate folks in as broad-based terms as possible, while still providing obviously facts and figures, that this is not going away. And the further we allow this to sort of settle and permeate, the worse it's going to become, and how it's just going to become, like everything that neoliberalism touches, it's systemic, and it connects to a lot of different things. And it's disproportionately, I cannot emphasize this enough, going to disproportionately affect communities of color as well, which I think is also something that we want to make sure we focus on too.
Absolutely. And I would even add to that, and to rural communities across the state. And, you know, the areas that if you look at, you know, one of the things, especially in the state of Pennsylvania, you see the areas that are targeted for these consolidations that are going to see the biggest amounts of job losses are also the ones that have been impacted the greatest by the extractive industries, by the oil and gas industries that have been wrecked, had their waters wrecked, had their infrastructure ripped away, and are kind of left in kind of the most unhealthy kind of like environments in the state. Those are exactly the areas that these schools are going to be consolidated against. You're going to see the majority of the impacts. I mean, there's the Perry study that came out, which we looked at before. You know, we're talking about 2,200 jobs total, right? When you're looking at direct and indirect impacts of these consolidations, that's huge. And the fact, I think that, you know, this is very pointed. This also came up in the hearing today from the president of one of the AFSCME locals. I'm forgetting the guy's name. But basically, he basically said, look, this is, you know, just like it says in the report, this is like the biggest like plant closings in the state. This is on that scale that we're talking about here and what that impact is. Right. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, what David said in the chat, too, is like 11% of the budget reduction is going to happen with or without the redesign. And I think this is one of the kind of smoke and mirrors moves that's going on right now with the consolidation stuff, because, you know, some of the critiques about this, you know, this impact study from UMass, from the political economic research institute, when their impact looking at what the consolidation would, or what this redesign would bring, Chancellor Greenstein keeps on pointing, it's like, well, we look at the impact is going to be minimal. But if when he got when he gets forced to answer questions on specifically what he means by that, he means post consolidation. When if you're looking at the redesign, and this is precisely what that economic impact that goes right to your point you were making, Alex, is that this has been the bleeding dry kind of going forward. So the 800 jobs that are being forced into retirement that you mentioned in your piece, right? 800 people being forced into retirement or actually strongly encouraged into retirement. Or else, right? You know, that kind of like is, you know, Greenstein wants to see those things as separate, but really this is part and parcel to kind of what happens, right? This is part and parcel to what this redesign has been and what's been going on for a long period of time, which is precisely why I think that, you know, half measures are just not going to work any longer.
Absolutely.
But crazy, crazy. One thing that I'll throw this there too as well. I don't know, John. We're gonna have to take this one up another time. John writes in YouTube. I actually would love to go down this rabbit hole, but I'm not gonna do it right now. He says nothing is free. Somebody pays the bill. If education is a priority, where do we get the money? If it is a priority, the money gets found. I think that's true. That goes back to the issue of choice. I've been trying to get somebody on the show for a while now. For a bit to talk about modern monetary theory. This doesn't apply at the state level, it applies at the federal level, it has to do with a bunch of other stuff. But if you read Stephanie Kelton's book, The Deficit Myth, she really kind of lays it out there. Look her up on YouTube, check her out. And I think this is absolutely critical as a way of understanding what goes forward. And I think this goes back to, you know, the whole purpose that you all are kind of doing is founding Posse Defenders. Is that you don't get what you don't fight for, right?
And exactly.
And we don't have the practice in having to answer the question about what is it that we want? And my view has always been about the hope for a liberatory education is that this is where we have to get the practice of determining the future that we want, not have to adapt. And this is that goes back to my training with Paul Freire. We don't have to adapt, right? Animals adapt to their environment, right? But if we are agents in the world, then we are part of a collective process of determining what our future looks like, not just adapting to what is handed to us. And I think that, you know, you're all kind of on your way of doing precisely that.
Well, thank you. That's a huge compliment. And yeah, Nick and I are, you know, very excited about this. And we are not in the belief system of negotiating before we even get to the table. It's a defeatist mindset. It's a defeatist strategy. And it is something that, you know, one of the, Dr. Ferguson says, I think in his book, We Demand, one of the most successful strategies that ruling classes and, dominant classes use to take the wind out of the sails of student movements and just movements in general, is to demean them and to make them think that they're asking for too much. So that way that the general public starts to think that, you know, this is where we get the sense of entitlement and the me generation, all this kind of stuff. It's a very successful, I have to admit, ploy to distract from the issues that are actually being like wanting to be discussed. If you take away the validity of these criticisms, then you're left with nothing. And I just feel like it's time for a change in strategy and not sort of placating to this defeatist mindset of, okay, well, like we'll make some concessions here before we even get to the negotiating table. I'm not saying concessions aren't necessary at times, but I'm just saying that using them now, again, a defeatist mindset. And in terms of funding for things, obviously it's always going to be a valid, you know, valid question, you know, going through things, but we need to make education a priority because it is a public good. And just because we divest it divest from it and the ruling class takes away the importance of it does not mean that the significance of it goes away. It's still there. It's just people have just turned their gazes away from it. So in terms of like what we wrote about in our op-ed that you guys can check out on the quad is like sales and income tax revenue alone generated $500 million more than originally estimated since the start of the pandemic, which was according to the PA Department of Revenue. So Greenstein himself has admitted, Nick, remind me what this meeting was over Zoom, but he said it is a policy choice. He even admits that the money is there. It's always been there. It's not a question of money, but it's the choices of where we spend it. So I don't, you know.
Yeah, and here's the quote. He says,
them on their own level at an economic. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, he says, like, I mean, to your point, it is a policy choice. It just is, Greenstein said. And you're right. The money is there. It's always been there. It always has been there. These are choices, right? We are choosing to spend it here and not there. The fact that money is not being there is not a meaningful excuse.
Yeah.
So this is what I mean about, like, last thing I'll say. This is what I mean about negotiating before we even get to the table.
Precisely.
He's already admitted that it's not a... It's not a question of money. It's a question of priorities. And we essentially, bare bones description of what we're trying to do, we want to reinstate education as a priority.
Agreed. And also I'll say, hey, Doc. And then also I see David in the chat of saying of, you know, Pashy trying to do a better job in terms of attracting, you know, students. I mean, you know, if you look at it over, you know, I want to say it is since like the year 2000, you know, Chancellor Greenstein is right. We have lost the affordability advantage, you know, that PA, you know, public schools or, you know, like higher education institutions used to have. But that's because of the fact that we haven't been funding it properly. And all of the increases in terms of, you know, like having new rock walls or having, you know, nice new residence halls or, you know, different things, really has all come out of student money. It's come out of tuition. It's come out of fees. And, you know, really that should be things that we try to get funded through the legislature. And, you know, sign off of what Alex was saying. Yeah, Greenstein knows it's a policy choice, but he doesn't, you know, either he doesn't conceive or he probably does, but he, you know, just paints himself out of the picture saying, I have nothing to do with this policy choice. Right. This is the hand I've been dealt and I can never change it. However, he does have power. If he actually wants to, you know, have a fully funded system, then he would actually try to work with APSCUF and try to work with students and try to get them together to fight against the legislature, which, yeah, do I think that they're going to give us, you know, anything and everything that we want? Probably not. But when we don't even fight for it, that's, you know, absurd.
I hear you 100%. And I'll tell you, you know, this is one of the reasons I tracked down some old video of Greenstein when he went to IUP a few years back in 2018. And he basically said to him, he's like, look, you know, I didn't land here by accident. I went shopping. I went shopping for a place just like this.
That was a good clip. That was a good clip.
Yeah, that was fun. Well, listen, you know, I want to thank you both so much for kind of coming on tonight. And, you know, please let me know. Keep me posted about what's happening. Let me know how I can help over the summer. Let me know what we can do to help kind of boost things out here with Raging Chicken. Because I can't tell you, you know, look, I know on the faculty end of things, we've got our work to do. Right. I mean, if we expect public higher education to be here, then we as a faculty need to kind of really kind of reorient ourselves towards an organizing model, I believe, where we are pushing back and we are not taking, you know, kind of like, well, we just can't do this as an answer. We have to organize and we have to be prepared to do what we did in 2016. We need to kind of shut it down if it does not, if they refuse to hear it. And I think that with faculty organizing, with students organizing, with the community organizing, that we do this together, you know, we really have an opportunity to kind of at least write a bit of that chapter for that future that I think we all want. So I appreciate the work that you all are doing tremendously. I can't even tell you. So thank you for being here tonight.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
You got it. Well,
go ahead, Alex. My bad. Philosopher says, as one of my favorite philosopher says, his name is Joel Embiid. He plays center for the Sixers. trust the process, but I actually want to disagree with Mr. Embiid on this time. We cannot trust the process anymore. We have to create our own new process. So even though I'm a diehard Sixers fan. I think we have to adopt a different ideology on this one. So
100%, I'm with you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Oh, you got it. I want to remind you, everybody, once again, that you can follow Poshy Defenders on Twitter at Defenders Poshy. That's one word, at Defenders Poshy. And also check them out on Instagram at Poshy _ Defenders. And they got a meeting coming up. You can check out in the show notes. We'll put the link in there. We got the link in the YouTube chat right now. Check them out on Thursday for their meeting at 7 p.m. You can sign up and see what it's all about. Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Alex, for being here tonight. And, you know, thank you all for tuning in. Great discussion in YouTube chat tonight. I absolutely love it. We will be back on Wednesday, actually, for a little thing that I'm going to call just one thing. Right, we'll be there on Wednesday, and look out! I think Cyril Mikulenko has got a piece coming out this week, and I think it should be hot. We'll see everybody. See ya.
No.